There's a quiet rebellion spreading on college campuses, and we need your help to support it. Earlier this year, news outlets reported a surge in young Catholic converts. Amid today's confusion, students are searching for clarity. And through the Thomistic Institute's campus chapters, they're finally finding it in the Catholic intellectual tradition. You can fuel this ongoing revival right now. A small gift of $25 or more directly supports our campus chapter program, equipping students with the tools they need in the new academic year. Help us meet the rising demand on campus. Visit ThomisticInstitute.org/donate or click the link in the episode notes to make your gift before September 17th.
Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at ThomisticInstitute.org.
I'm really tempted to say, and now for something completely different, because there's a sense in which it will be completely different from what you've heard before, but we'll keep carrying on in the same themes in sort of a different register. So the object of the game here is to connect conscience to formation, because I don't know about you all, but I've listened to the last four lectures, thinking, really interesting, really, really interesting. How do I do that? So how do I do that? I actually gave a talk to a catechesis group in Edinburgh online, and somebody was like, well, so do you have a plan for how I use the rosary, like a 12-step plan? And I was like, no, sorry. This is spiritual formation. It unfolds. Just let it unfold. So we've heard, thanks to Father David, about Aquinas talking about conscience as the application of knowledge to an act. What I have to say to you is that process actually requires imagination, which is why I'm talking about imagination. Because usually, when we are discerning something, we're not sort of weighing propositions. It's not overly intellectual, right? We need to be able to imagine ourselves in the situation that we're in and combine kind of what we know with what's in front of us. That's the imagination. It's not just in make-believe, but it's in those sorts of judgments as well. And the other thing that really struck me was talking about the fact that conscience, for Thomas Aquinas, is part of what makes us human. It's part of the whole set of features of human being. And so what I'm going to be talking about is much broader, sort of in the broader daily life, how do we do conscience? How does conscience move us? How do we think about it? How are we formed? How do we form it? John Henry Newman tells us two important things about conscience that I want to sort of draw out. You've heard them already from Lewis, but first, that, quote, training and experience are necessary for its strength, growth, and due formation. So that's one. Second, which we've already heard once today, conscience is not a long-sighted selfishness, nor a desire to be consistent with oneself, but it is a messenger from him, who both in nature and in grace speaks to us behind a veil and rules us by his representatives. I might add to that from this morning the thought about, and it's refracted in all of us, right? It's refracted. All of our lives and the way that our lives unfold change the way that conscience unfolds, change the way that we hear God's voice. Okay? So, what I propose to you is that one of the key ways in which our conscience is formed is by forming our imagination, which is nurtured and filled by stories. I'm really bad at technology, I'm just going to warn you right now. Okay, and here I'm in very good company. So Alistair MacIntyre has famously observed, in After Virtue, of course, where all good MacIntyre quotes come, from which, yeah, the human creature is essentially a storytelling animal. The key question for us, though, is not about our own authorship. That is, it isn't primarily, I think, about the stories we tell. They're important, but they're not the important thing for what I'm going to say today. McIntyre says, I can only answer the question, what am I to do, if I can answer the prior question of what story or stories do I find myself a part. So I'm suggesting that doing the thing that conscience asks us to do is often, not always, of course, but often, a matter of recognizing our part in a story. So I have two examples for you. The first is Mary, Our Lady, who makes a leap, instinct and courage, I think, in saying yes, right, to bearing Christ. And the other one, now for something completely different, is Frodo Baggins. Okay. And I didn't know about the connection to Tolkien when I was planning this. It just sort of arrived, and I was like, thank you. So, Mary's yes. Oh, come on, go forward. That please. Oh, I said please, and then it worked. I don't know, that's a bit weird. So, Mary's consent is free. It was helped a lot because she was free from sin, but it's still free. If you want to know more about that, read the Summa, part 3, question 30. Go for it. Have fun. I'm not going to give any exposition of it today. Instead, I am going to tell you something that Newman says about Mary in University Sermon 15. He says, thus St. Mary is our pattern of faith, both in the reception and in the study of divine truth. She does not think it enough to accept. She dwells upon it. Not enough to possess, she uses it. Not enough to assent, she develops it. Not enough to submit to reason, she reasons upon it. Not indeed reasoning first and believing afterwards with Zacharias, yet first believing without reasoning, next from love and reverence, reasoning after believing. And thus she symbolizes to us not only the faith of the unlearned, but of the doctors of the church also, who have to investigate and weigh and define, as well as to profess the gospel, to draw the line between truth and heresy, to anticipate or remedy the various aberrations of wrong reason, to combat pride and recklessness with their own arms, and thus to triumph over the sophist and the innovator. Get a bit of Newman sort of, yes. He is against something here. But the key thing is not indeed reasoning first and believing afterwards, but believing without reasoning, reasoning after believing is what she does. So Mary's in the story, and she knows, I think, what story she's in. She says yes before she really thinks about the story, right? She must know the story that she's in. She must, you know? Because otherwise, nothing that was happening would make any sense to her. But she just says, yeah, okay. And then she thinks about it on her way to meet Elizabeth, I think. You know? You're mulling this over. You're pondering it, right? If you've listened to Newman, you're pondering it. You're thinking, okay, what? I've said yes to this. What on earth is going on really here? You know? Her place in the story is, you know, this is what it is. She takes up her role in the story, and she's thinking about what that means, and then she says something. And I thought about reading out the Magnificat as we have it in the, you know, in the office. And then I thought, no, sometimes it's actually quite interesting to hear a different translation. So this is not a translation with which I'm familiar, so if I don't sound like completely smooth reading it, it's because of that. So this is what she says. My soul extols the Lord, and my spirit has exulted in God my Savior, because he has looked favorably on the humble state of his slave girl. For look, from now on all generations will congratulate me, because the powerful one has done great things for me, and holy is his name. And his mercy is for generation after generation on those who fear him. He has done a mighty deed with his arm. He has scattered those who are hungry, haughty in the thoughts of their heart. He has deposed rulers from their thrones and raised up the humble. The hungry he has filled with good things, and the wealthy he has sent away empty. He has helped his servant Israel, remembering his mercy, as he spoke to our ancestors, to Abraham and his descendants forever. So there's this move from what she said, yes. And then in the Magnificat, she looks in two different directions, right? She says, henceforth, as we know it, all generations will call me blessed. Congratulate me, sound a bit weird. Will call me blessed. So this is something that has a massive impact on the future. But it's also something that is consistent with the past, right? She speaks of two sets of generations, the generations that came before her, among whom she is one, her generation, and the generations that come after her. She finds her place in the story. This is her story. And she's taken on the role that God has offered to her in Gabriel. Okay. Enough Bible. Let's go to Middle Earth. Not that I don't love the Bible, I do. I really do. I survived my teenage years on the Psalms. I never would have lived through it without the Psalms. There's all sorts of good things in there. Whatever it is that you're feeling, as a Benedictine sister once said to me, there's a Psalm for that. I said, you know what, you're so right, sister. There's always a Psalm for that, whatever's going on. Right, but here's Frodo. And we're going to talk about Frodo kind of a lot between now and the end of this hour. And also again tomorrow. Okay, so this is obviously a scene from the film. Unfortunately, Tolkien didn't illustrate everything in ways that you can access. I've tried to use his illustrations when I can. So Gandalf puts Frodo in the story. He's explaining to Frodo what's happened. How the ring came to Bilbo, Gollum, and all that. Is there anyone who doesn't actually know this story? Okay. So I don't have to give a lot of background. I can just read it out. You know, not everyone's seen these. I have to, you know. I said to my brother something about Harry Potter. He's like, no. No films? No. Books? No. Hagrid? No. I was like, okay, I don't know what hole you've been hiding in. But, right. So, Gandalf is kind of explaining. See, here's what's happened, right? It was not Gollum, Frodo, but the ring itself that decided things. The ring left him. What, just in time to meet Bilbo, said Frodo. Wouldn't an orc have suited it better? It is no laughing matter, said Gandalf. Not for you, because this is your story, even though you don't accept that yet. It was the strangest event in the whole history of the ring so far. Bilbo's arrival just at that time, and putting his hand on it blindly in the dark. There was more than one power at work, Frodo. The ring was trying to get back to its master. It had slipped from Isildur's hand and betrayed him. Then when a chance came, it caught poor Deagle, and he was murdered. And after that, Gollum, and it had devoured him. It could make no further use of him. He was too small and mean, and as long as it stayed with him, he would never leave his deep pool again. So now, when its master was awake once more and sending out his dark thought from Mirkwood, it abandoned Gollum, only to be picked up by the most unlikely person imaginable, Bilbo from the Shire. Behind that, there was something else at work, beyond any design of the Ringmaker. I can put it no plainer than by saying that Bilbo was meant to find the ring, and not by its maker. In which case, you also were meant to have it. And that may be an encouraging thought. It is not, said Frodo. And I'll stop there with this particular bit. Because Frodo's like, I don't really want to be in this story. Thanks. This is just not it. And a bit further behind this, it's like, I wish it need not have happened in my time. And this comes out in the films too, so everyone knows it, you know, but that's not for us to decide, except it happens much earlier in the story and in the books. That's not for us to decide. He's already begun to sort of say, you've got a part to play in this. Frodo does not want this part. He does not want to play this part. He does not want to do it. And so there's in the background of The Lord of the Rings this struggle, and we'll see more about the struggle tomorrow, to own the story, to go, okay, I'm in the story, I'm not the author of the story, but this is my story. It goes like this, this is my part, and I play my part. One foot in front of the other, yeah? And that's essentially what it is. The decision is always, do I take the other step forward, or do I turn around and go back to the Shire? There's no like in between, right? Yeah? Yes, it ever goes on. And so does the story, as we'll see. So then he gets to Rivendell, right? You guys all know this. And he finds himself in the story again. Now, tomorrow we'll talk about the bit where he says yes. What? That wasn't supposed to happen. That wasn't a part of the story. But it's not important. Because Elrond then gives Frodo a place in the story. That as I was reading it again and thinking through this, I thought that's really interesting. So, after Frodo says his famous line, he will take the ring. Elrond raised his eyes and looked at him, and Frodo felt his heart pierced by the sudden keenness of the glance. If I understand aright all that I have heard, he said, I think that this task is appointed for you, Frodo, and that if you do not find a way, no one will. This is the hour of the Shire folk, when they arise from their quiet fields to shake the towers and councils of the great. Who of all the wise could have foreseen it? Or, if they are wise, why should they expect to know it until the hour has struck? But it is a heavy burden, so heavy that none could lay it on another. I do not lay it on you. But if you take it freely, I will say that your choice is right. And though all the mighty elf friends of old, Hador and Húrin and Túrin and Beren himself were assembled together, your seat should be among them. Elrond puts Frodo in the story in a really interesting place. Because he doesn't put Frodo in the beginning of the story. He puts Frodo at the end of the story. It's almost like he sees into Frodo's heart and says, yeah, it's going to happen. And his seat, he gets his seat among the elf friends of old when he says yes. Not when the quest is accomplished, not when it's finished. But there's something very important in accepting and saying, okay, I take this freely. I take this freely. I'll give it a go. And again, we'll see more about Frodo's struggle actually to get there tomorrow. Just making sure that what I wrote in my notes that I was supposed to say is what I just said, and it is. So I'll just skip the bit where it falls on the floor. But this isn't always, you know, Frodo doesn't always kind of live into the story. He's not always convinced, this is my story, I'm happy, I'm getting on with it. And this is kind of a long bit, so you'll have to bear with me. It's also not in the Fellowship of the Ring, it's in the Two Towers, at the end of the Two Towers. Because I think that there's a really important thing to recognize about what's going on as Frodo and Sam, so this is where Sam puts Frodo in the story, I should advance his line. Okay, Sam finds their place in the story. Sam tells Frodo, he doesn't realize it. He realizes as he's talking, you know, if you're an extrovert, I'm sure this has happened to you, you realize as you're talking, hey, wait, something's, I'm realizing something as I'm speaking. So he realizes that we're in the story. We have a part in this really big story that involves all those elf lords, you know, elf friends of old. So they are... getting up to Cirith Ungol, which is not a nice place, as Sam observes. There's a wicked feeling about this place, he sniffed, and a smell, I fancy. Do you notice it? A queer kind of smell, stuffy. I don't like it. I don't like anything here at all, said Frodo. Step or stone, breath or bone, earth, air, and water all seem accursed, but so our path is laid. This is the way that we're going. This is just what has happened to us. We put one foot in front of the other on this journey, and this is where it brought us. I don't like it, but this is how our path is laid. Yes, that's so, said Sam. And we shouldn't be here at all if we'd known more about it before we started. But I suppose it's often that way. The brave things in the old tales and songs, Mr. Frodo, adventures as I used to call them. I used to think that they were things the wonderful folk of the stories went out and looked for because they wanted them, because they were exciting and life was a bit dull, a kind of sport, as you might say. But that's not the way of it with the tales that really matter or the ones that stay in the mind. Folks seem just to have been landed in them, usually. Their paths were laid that way, as you put it. But I expect they had lots of chances, like us, of turning back. Only they didn't. And if they had, we shouldn't know, because they'd have been forgotten. We hear about those as just went on, not all to a good end, mind you. At least not to what folk inside a story, not outside it, call a good end. You know, coming home and finding things all right, though not quite the same. Like old Mr. Bilbo. But those aren't always the best tales to hear, though they may be the best tales to get landed in. I wonder what a sort of a tale we've fallen into. And it's interesting, because when you were speaking, when you were preaching earlier, Father David, thinking about people getting into something and not really knowing, and that they might not have gotten into it if they knew what they were getting into. That's another sort of sense of theme. Like, if we'd known what we were about, we probably wouldn't have done this, you know? Merry and Pippin had no idea what they were getting into. They might not have chosen it, and I think they actually say that at one point. You know, we signed up for this, but this isn't what we thought we signed up for, right? Okay, so Frodo says, I wonder, but I don't know. And that's the way of a real tale. Take any one that you're fond of. You may know or guess what kind of a tale it is, happy ending or sad ending, but the people in it don't know, and you don't want them to. No, sir, of course not. Baron now, he never thought that he was going to get that Silmaril from the Iron Crown in Thangorodrim. And yet he did, and that was a worse place and a blacker danger than ours. But that's a long tale, of course, and goes on past the happiness and into grief and beyond it. And the Silmaril went on and came to Arendil. And, why, sir, I never thought of it before. You've got some of the light of it in that star glass that the lady gave you. Why, to think of it, we're in the same tale still. It's going on. Don't the great tales never end? No, they never end as tales, said Frodo. But the people in them come and go when their part's ended. Our part will end later or sooner. We're not quite done with this passage, so I'll leave it open. So there's this important moment here where Sam says, yeah, this is the story. Hang on a minute. This is the story. This isn't just our story. This is just the way that our path is laid. But this path that we're on is laid like it's we're on a path that started way before us and will continue a long time after us. No matter what happens, the great tale will still go on. Which I think is really important, actually, because when we think about the weightiness of matters of conscience, and some of the sort of you have to like don't have an erring conscience. It's like, okay, good. So what happens if I do? The good news is, God is bigger than your errors of conscience, right? Not that we shouldn't work our hardest, right? But that there is grace. But that's for tomorrow. That's for tomorrow. So they get on their path. Okay, this is not just our path, but this is the path. The road goes ever on, and it started a long time ago. So, and Sam says, yes, and we can have some sleep. Right? Still, I wonder if we shall ever be put into songs or tales. We're in one, of course, but I mean put into words, you know, told by the fireside, or read out of a great big book with red and black letters years and years afterwards. And people will say, let's hear about Frodo and the Ring. And they'll say, yes, that's one of my favorite stories. Frodo was very brave, wasn't he, Dad? Yes, my boy, the famousest of the hobbits, without saying a lot. Saying a lot too much, said Frodo. And he laughed, a long, clear laugh from his heart. Yeah, and this is really important. You might not think so, but it is. Because such a sound had not been heard in those places since Sauron came to Middle-earth. To Sam, suddenly, it seemed as if all the stones were listening and the tall rocks leaning over them. But Frodo did not heed them. He laughed again. Why, Sam, he said, to hear you somehow makes me as merry as if the story was already written. So finding their place, finding that their path is in this bigger story, it does something in two places, right? It does something inside of Frodo. He laughed, right? Frodo has not been in a good place. he's been in a bad place, and he gets to even worse places. He's not, right, in a mood to laugh. But he laughed, a long, clear laugh from his heart. Something is loosened in Frodo at this time. But then there's something else loosened in Middle Earth. There's like, it's, you know, it's like Father Christmas coming in you know, in the First Chronicles of Narnia book, yeah? Father Christmas appears, always winter, never Christmas, and that's a sign that the power of the witch is weakening. Anyone? Yes? Okay, good. That there's this breaking of the dark power. The darkness is broken a little bit here because nobody's laughed at this particular place, you know, since Sauron came to power, right? So, you know, this is a step forward. Something is happening. I think I won't read the bit about Sam, but it is quite lovely. But Sam's, so Frodo then observes, but you've left out one of the best parts, which is Samwise, and Frodo wouldn't have got far without him, without Sam, would he, Dad? And Frodo recognizes this. Good. Right. So, last slide. Whew, we're well in time, which is good. You never know. So why does Frodo go on? This is the big question. This is the thing to think about next time you watch the film, The Two Towers. And Sam says, oh, but Mr. Frodo, there's still good in the world. It's like, no, sorry, that's not it. And that's not enough, right? There's still good in the world, and you might achieve your goal. It's just not enough. Not for what they're facing, not for the journey that they're on. Frodo actually needs to have found his place in that bigger story. He needs what's come before him, he needs what's going after him in order to have the courage to carry on. And Lisa and I had an argument about this last night, mostly because I was really tired and irritable. So, but about whether Frodo does his duty. And I think, oh, well, I don't think so. I guess you could talk about it like that. But I think there's a reason that Tolkien doesn't talk about it like that. And that is because it's not a sense of like, okay, this is what I've got to do. It's much more of a stepping into something, right? If you think God has prepared the good works that we should walk in them, right? Frodo is stepping into those good works, though it seems pretty dark at the moment that he's stepping into them. Frodo keeps going because that's the way his path is laid. And, as Elrond said, if you don't find a way, no one will. So he is, there's not much hope. That's another theme in Lord of the Rings. Gandalf, is there any hope for Frodo? Well, Gandalf says, there never was much hope. Great, thanks. you know, there's no hope. It is. You just look at it and you think, yeah, it's hopeless. How are they ever going to get there? But that's not what it's about either. It's not about the hope. It's about, like, if I don't find a way, no one will. So I have to trust that this is the way, you know, this is the way that I'm going. And that at the same time, I think, he has to realize, though this is me extrapolating now, he has to realize that ultimately it's not up to him. The quest is a heavy burden. It is laid on his shoulders. But there is another power at work, right? It's the power that lightens his heart so he can laugh, right? It's the power that reminds Sam of the journey that they're on. This is the other power that is at work. You know, everything that seems like luck. Luck is a big thing in The Hobbit, but less so in Lord of the Rings, I think. You know, there's more than one power as it were. So if I don't find a way, no one will. So that seems like it's a really heavy burden, so I've got to keep on going. And yet at the same time, the fate of Middle-earth doesn't actually rest solely in Frodo's hands, because more than one power is always at work. So the response to evil, this great evil in The Lord of the Rings, is, in a sense, you know, the freedom of conscience of one very, very small inhabitant of Middle-earth. will he go on or will he not go on? And he goes on, and Middle Earth is saved, but not for him. I think I'll stop there.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.